I protest. Glad to have you on the live stream, as we do every Friday from 5 to 7 p.m. Our first guest, we're supposed to have two guests. Hopefully, we're going to get the other person on shortly. Josh Hardison experienced a tragedy similar to mine with my brother recently, the same, in very similar circumstances. So we're going to have, as we've had the last few weeks, we're going to try to have people like this that have gone through this on to try to tell their story. So Josh, I appreciate you coming on. I know it's not easy to tell the story, so thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So you wrote me and told me in detail. So go and tell your story however you want to tell it, however much detail you want. And, again, we're all very sorry for your loss. But tell us what happened. I'm sure the audience would be.
Well, I guess it started out a month before my wife tested positive. She had the same symptoms as she did the time she did test positive. And that time her OB told her, you know, you could take this medication, this, that, and other. And, you know, it was just simple over-the-counter stuff. And she kicked it off like it was no big deal. And then end of November, she actually had the same symptoms, tested positive for COVID. And then the OB said, hey, don't take none of that stuff basically you took before. And I found out later, he's like, yeah, I can facilitate monoclonal antibodies, but he highly recommended it against it being, you know, he's facilitated it for other patients and they had great success. It's just the whole thing with people going to the hospital is very unfortunate. And it's literally like people say that, you know, if you get COVID, don't go to the hospital. My wife came down with COVID, had symptoms for a week, and by the weekend started getting worse. Didn't really get no response out of the OB because my wife was pregnant. So then that Sunday night, she was shortness of breath. She asked me to take her to the hospital. I didn't know what to do, so I took her to the hospital. And then when I got to the ER, I knew I messed up because they didn't even want me to get out of the car. They wanted me to just drop her off and leave and let them do whatever they wanted to do. And so I made it crystal clear that, and she was on board that she didn't want the remdesivir, and they had her in there. They told me to wait in the parking lot. I waited for, you know, 6-8 hours in the middle of the morning. No response from nurses. I got the same response a few times during my wife's stay. Oh, well, your wife has a cell phone. Just call her up. Or they just wouldn't even talk to me. So she told them she didn't want remdesivir that first night. Or sometime the morning or Monday, they told her it was an antibody infusion, and they gave her remdesivir. So, to my knowledge, the hospital gave it to her twice and then sent in a kidney specialist. But, you know, now I have her medical records and I'm reading in those, and a lot of the stuff doesn't match up to the stuff I was told while she was there. So, we'll just go to that Tuesday. They gave her second, or the medical record says third dose of remdesivir, and then they're sending in a kidney specialist. So I'm on the phone explaining this stuff to her and telling her not to freak out, but she needs to refuse it the next time they come to give it. And she was on board with that. And, you know, you call the hospital and try to get report. Nobody really wants to tell you anything. I'm in North Carolina, and we have the No Patient Left Alone Act. So they had to let me in the hospital. Granted, it was only for 2 hours a day, and every day I saw her, she would do better. But so she was in the hospital for 3 days. That was that Tuesday. I'm calling the hospital trying to talk to a physician. They won't call me back. The nurses give me pretty lame responses when I talk to them. So then the OB shows up. He wouldn't talk to me on the phone. And I mean, beyond rude. I mean, I could quote what he said, but it was like, luckily I had prayed for, discernment and words of wisdom. I mean, it was just unbelievable what he said, and he blamed everything on everybody else. So then the following day, and this whole time she's in there, she's on a nasal cannula, and she's pretty congested through her nose, so she's not moving any air through her nose. So, a nasal cannula blows air in your nose, and it's pretty useless if you're congested. So I've been asking everybody that would listen about a mask, and nobody wanted to hear nothing. And so then the following day, they put her on a what's called heated high flow oxygen, which is it's like a nasal cannula. It looks almost like a water hose that goes under your nose, and they blow in about 50 liters of oxygen in a minute. And if you don't know anything about like liters per minute, I can take 50 liters of oxygen and cut 2-inch thick steel with it. So at this point, I get to go on Wednesday. I've already been talking to the ICU doctors because they moved her up to the ICU from there. And some of the nurses slipped up and told me that when she crashes, they're going to have to do a C-section. So I have people in my family in the medical field. I have a little medical experience. And I thought was, if you want her to crash to do the C-section, why don't we just schedule a C-section? Well, the ICU doc basically, he said the OB wanted no part of it, and that he kind of, without saying so, he agreed with me that it would be better. And it's like I explained that, then you'd have two viable patients to deal with separately, and you don't have to restrict one because of the other. So they did the C-section. Of course, they wanted to kick me out of the hospital every chance they got. And luckily I was able to, use my wit to stay there and convince other people to walk me around and get through some of these blockades. But they did the C-section, and after that, my wife was a real small frame. Baby come out kicking, screaming, grabbing stuff, doing great. My wife had so much more room in her abdomen, she could actually breathe in. Well, actually, that was on a Wednesday, the 8th. Through the weekend, she did great. Did great. Was doing better every day. They moved her back down to intermediate care out of the ICU. After that Monday, I think she woke up coughing. They don't let me in except from 4 to 6 in the afternoon. And I get a couple texts from her. She won't answer the phone. I could tell she wasn't feeling well. And, I call the nurse, and they give me the runaround, and I find out they're putting her on this drug called Precedex. And for my research, a lot of times they use Precedex for, outpatient procedures where they do, intubation for a procedure for a shorter period of time, and it's not supposed to affect your respiratory or anything. So they put her on Precedex that day, and I find that out, and I'm calling everybody, and everybody's like, "Oh, it's no big deal." But now, upon reading the medical records, less than an hour after giving her Precedex, they gave her morphine, which definitely suppresses your respiratory system. And at this point, I find out she's in respiratory distress, and I'm at the hospital, begging with anybody that I'll answer the phone because they won't let me in for just 15 minutes. You give me 15 minutes, we can avoid this. And they're threatening her. If she can't calm down, they're going to intubate her. So at 4 o'clock, when they finally let me in, she's in pretty good respiratory distress, and the cowboy doctor says, "Oh, you need to leave and go home." Well, of course, I refuse, and then they kick me out of the room and tell me they're going to intubate, and they intubate my wife, and find out a couple days later, they give you propofol and fentanyl, and of course, they won't give her the minimum dose. They just go ahead and max everything out every time they give you something. I mean, it's bad when you have financial incentivized diagnosis and financial incentivized treatment. So they intubated my wife, and I'm devastated, and it's I can't see my child because she's in isolation because my wife had COVID and I'm around her. I mean, they told me not even to go back and see my wife after the C-section. They told me to go home and isolate so I could be there for Charlotte. So they intubate my wife. It goes good through the week, and they her ventilator settings go down through the week. And come that Friday, they talk about taking the tube out and stuff. And, you know, they had her on a paralytic too to make her paralyzed, because they would prone her, put her face down to try to help. And it was an awful experience. And the way they treat you in the hospital, it was like, it's like something you'd read out of a war manual about psychological warfare. I mean, they break your loved ones down that are trying to advocate for you, and they restrict you're seeing your loved ones. So you really can't advocate for them. And, so back to that Friday, they gave her some medicines through her ET or through her feeding tube. And, you know, I'm in there documenting everything, and you ask them what they're giving, and they give you a shortened list compared to what the medical records say. And so they gave her this other drug, and Diamox, and she was on that a year or so ago for another issue, and really couldn't take it. Her body didn't like it. And it's an old drug, and from what I hear, it's not a very good drug at all. And it has a bunch of complications with other drugs or counterindications. So they give that to her. They take her off the paralytic, and her body doesn't like it. I mean, she's flailing. They don't know what the deal is. They put her back on the paralytic and say they'll try again in the morning. So they go back at it again in the morning, take her off the paralytic. And, you know, it's kind of weird, because I get 2 hours in there, and they wait to do anything for the 2 hours that I'm there. So I get there, they take the tube out. Of course, they have to kick me out of the room to take the tube out, because it's supposedly sterile environment, which is not. And they take the tube out, and they had gave her that Diamox again that day that I didn't realize. They never told me about at this point. So then they give her a breathing treatment, and it was weird, because, you know, you give albuterol, normally that makes your oxygen rate go up and your heart rate go up, and everything they give her, it did the complete opposite. I mean, her oxygen went down, her heart rate went down. Respiratory therapist kind of freaking out about it. And through the afternoon, they let me stay a little later, and her respirations kept going up, and her respirations were shorter, and I knew what the inevitable was. They kicked me out, and they reintubated her on that Saturday. So then the following Sunday, I'm in there, and she's intubated, and they're talking about how good she's doing. And at this point, it had been 21 days from her first symptom, and I had fought with patient relations and ethics committee administrators every day that she's been there about, you know, more time. You know, you asked them, hey, do you believe a loved one being near another loved one had helped them heal? And everybody would be like, oh, absolutely. And, you know, of course, I'd hit them with, well, why would you restrict that to 2 hours a day? I mean, I'm in there for 2 hours and she does so much better. I mean, do you want her to get better, or do you want to keep her in there? And they obviously wanted to keep her in there, I feel like. And, you know, I'd asked them other questions as well about, you know, they never did a COVID test on my wife when she was there. And I finally had, after I was, you know, I was at a loss because my wife's been intubated for a week. I finally had a ethics committee administrator basically tell me that, you know, I asked her straight out, if you give a COVID test and she's negative, and of course they'd interrupt you and be like, well, you know, they could test positive for 6 months. And I'm like, but just hear me out. If she's negative, then you're telling me you just can't charge for this stuff. And they're like, pretty much. Sure. So that Sunday, I was in there for longer because it was 21 days from her first symptom. And they gave her meds down her feeding tube, which, of course, they didn't really tell me what they were. They gave me a dumbed down version. So they kicked me out. And, you know, I leave a note with the nurse. If you have any issues, please give me a call. And of course, you know, just like every other day she was in the hospital, it was really like the night shift doesn't report to the day shift. So I would call, I'd wake up at 5 o'clock every morning to get a report from the night shift nurse, call in. And so I call in, and they said she had crashed overnight, but she'd stabilized. So of course, you know, I get my stuff together and get to the hospital as quick as I can. And I get there and I see the pressure infusion bags around the IV bag, probably about four of them hanging up in the room. And I know that's really bad. I know her pressure had to drop out of the bottom, and the monitor's showing her pressure about mid 70s over mid 30s, which is pretty bad in its own. And so that morning, her vitals come back a little bit, and then, you know, a neurologist come in the room and talked about the Diamox, which I had no idea she was on. And basically, he was real apologetic and told me that, you know, it's basically like dealing with that at this point was treating somebody with a splinter in my wife's condition. And so then, you know, I go to the nursing station and find out how long she's been on it. And then talking to some other people in the pharmacy world, it was kind of crushing because, you know, my mind's just going and I'm looking back through my mind and seeing what happened and how stuff didn't go as planned and people are texting me stuff. So, you know, the whole time my wife's in the hospital, you know, I got faith and I'm praying and I just couldn't imagine what happened would happen. And so we make it through that Monday and I guess she's been in the hospital about 2 weeks. And the next day I go in, of course, you know, they don't call and tell you anything. And I get there and then the nurse tells me, you know, her kidneys have shut down and she quit making urine and I need to sign this form for the dialysis. And of course I do that. And they start her on dialysis and have problems with the machines doing that. And, you know, the filter's clogging up and the line's clogging up. So they change that a few times, give her some blood. And, you know, December the 22nd, the following day, you know, they take her off the ventilator and they would bag her for a little bit. And then they put her back on the ventilator. And about lunchtime, they basically tell me there's nothing else they can do. And, you know, of course, the whole time she's in there, I'm asking questions, which really they really did not like me asking questions. No, I mean,
they don't like that.
That first Tuesday she's in there, I'm talking to the OB and, you know, he's everybody in there's all they want to do is tell you to tell your friends to get the vaccine, all that. That's all they want to talk about. You should have got the vaccine. Your friends should have got the vaccine. You need to tell everybody to get the vaccine. But that first Tuesday, the OB, I'm asking him questions and he literally looks at me and this is unbelievable. He says, "Hey, I can change the oil in my car, but I don't go to the mechanic and start pointing my finger and telling him what to do because he's going to give me the bird and tell me to shut up." And, you know, I looked at him and as calm as I could, I was like, "Are you telling me to shut up?" And then he goes on to, you know, blame everything on the internal medicine doctor at the hospital who, you know, at this point wouldn't even return a phone call or nothing else. And it was just unbelievable when they intubated my wife, the cowboy doctor. I'm asking about monoclonal antibodies again. And he tells me it's too late for that. You asked about, you know, vitamin infusions, whatever else. They don't want to hear that. And you know, then, of course, I say the I word at the end, the ivermectin. What about ivermectin?
Oh,
and, of course, he blows me out.
Yeah.
Oh, that's junk medicine. You heard of junk science? That's junk medicine. And you got to leave. So it's just really unbelievable. And, you know, the whole time I'm there, I got printouts of the research on the ivermectin. And I got printouts on the research of the remdesivir. Nobody wants to hear anything bad about remdesivir. No. And every question or any response I had, everybody literally had a scripted answer down to the word and the emotion. It was like, you know, you turn on CNN one night and then flip over to CBS or Fox. It's like, you know, the Mockingbird News, word for word. And then, you know, after they told me there was nothing else I could do, I pulled out, you know, the right to try legislation. And then the doctor, I guess he thought he was a comedian. He's like, you know, that's for drug companies. And I'm like, drug companies can make whatever they want. Yeah. It's the healthcare provider and the physician to prescribe and administer the drugs. The drug companies have no business doing that. And then of course he printed off some little printout from the hospital that was written by a lawyer. That was really, it was another joke. It was written by another comedian. Yeah. And you know, and then the night, you know, night shift changed before my wife passed. And I just couldn't believe it. They come in and they're like, "Hey, would you like us to give her some comforting drugs?" And I'm like, "Comforting drugs? What do you mean?" And they're like, "Well, you know, we can, you know, stop the the propofol and the fentanyl and take the tube out and give her some, you know, morphine and other stuff to make her comfortable. And of course, you know, I'm not one to sugarcoat it. I had a background in construction and, you know, tend to be very blunt. And I'm like, oh, like a dog, you're just going to put it down on the table. And, you know, the nurses don't really, they don't want to hear that. I mean, they're all brainwashed in there anyway. It's really unbelievable. And then the, you know, other stories I hear and I mean, I heard of somebody else at the same hospital. They told his father-in-law that, you know, you need to get your people in here to see him because, you know, there's nothing else we can do. And the guy has cows, draws up a syringe of ivermectin, and 2 days later, the guy walks out of there. And now I know of other hospitals in the area that aren't, you know, they're small hospitals, but their first line treatment is ivermectin. And I've met with physicians, and there was a couple of legislators, representatives at a meeting. I met with these physicians, NC Physicians for Freedom. And everybody in that group, they're pushing the ivermectin, the hydroxychloroquine, and not one single provider has lost a patient. I mean, some of them had a small percentage that ended up in the hospital, but nobody died.
Well, Josh, obviously, my heart goes out to you, and you know, I experienced a loss too, so I know what you're going through, and I really appreciate you going into such detail, and you get a lot of good feedback in the chat room here. People feel for you, but I want to we're going to come back to you, but I want to come to our other guest, Stephanie Heron, who is more fortunate than you and I both in that she survived quite the ordeal, and she's here to tell her story. But she experienced a lot of the same stuff. Stephanie, welcome to the show, and thanks for sharing your.
Hey, I'm glad to be here. I just want to say that I am fortunate, and hearing stories where people weren't so fortunate, it makes me sad. And I guess it's a little bit of survivor's guilt because I wonder why me, you know, why I was spared and somebody else wasn't. So I just want to tell you guys, I'm sorry for your losses. And basically, it's a horrible, horrible place to be in the hospital. Your families are treated awful. And I think that was the hardest thing for me is how my family was treated. And they were not updated. They actually avoided phone calls from my family. I was put in the hospital at the end of September, September the 28th. I was took to one hospital. I was transferred to another hospital, and that's where I ended up being put on a ventilator because I was combative. Of course I was combative. You know, I had this tube over, you know, my face. I couldn't breathe. I woke up, and I was just talking to my daughter about it, trying to get her to refresh my memory, and she was telling me that they had to intubate me because I was being combative and pulling my face mask off. And I remember waking up, and I had a really, really bad IV, and they were trying to take my IV and replace it. And there was the doctor, the attending physician was there, and I remember her being to the side of me. They were holding me down physically. I was already restrained, okay? And they were physically holding me down when I woke up. And the doctor, and I'm sure I didn't understand her language, okay? She was not Southern talking, not really American talking. I think she was an Indian doctor. And I couldn't really understand her, what she was saying, but she was screaming at me. And she said, if you don't quit fighting us, I'm going to put this tube down your throat. I'm going to put this tube down your throat. And I remember begging her, saying, please don't, please don't. And that's the last thing I remember. Okay, so apparently that's what they did. They put the tube down my throat. And I was there on the ventilator for 8 days. My family, they were pretty much a wreck because when I was moved into the COVID care unit from ICU, I was getting taken care of very well. when I got moved into the COVID care unit and put on the ventilator, that's when it all went downhill and communication was lost with my family. Okay. I got put on a, my daughter called one late one afternoon. It was about 9 o'clock and wanted to get an update on me. And they said, well, everything is fine. Her stats are still the same. Vital's still the same. Nothing's really changed. Was just very short with my daughter. And so my daughter's like, well, you know, that doesn't sound quite right because this has not been the way it has been before. So she called back about midnight. Same nurse answered and said, aren't you the person I just talked to? She is fine. Nothing has changed. So my daughter, you know, was really upset. And she was like, I just had a bad feeling about it. I didn't think that you were fine. I thought something was wrong. Well, she was right, because about 5 the next morning, they called my husband to let him know that they had put me on the ventilator during the night. These things happen during the night when your family is sleeping. And that's what bothers me so bad. They had to know their plans at midnight for me. But yet my family had already asked them, if you have to put her on a ventilator, please let us know, because we don't know if we want that. Because I thought I was so sick that I needed hospice, because I asked for hospice. The last time I was conscious, I asked for hospice. I said, if I am this sick, I don't want to be on a ventilator. I don't, you know, because I'd heard horror stories. I said, I just don't want that for myself. I don't want that for my family. Please just let me go home and call hospice. Oh, no, 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 no. That didn't happen. And my husband told him, if you have to put her on a ventilator, let that be the last resort. And but I want to know before you do it, because, you know, I just want to make sure. Well, 5 hours later was when he got informed about it. And I was there on that for 8 days. I ended up having a catheter that had gotten stopped up with proteins. And I remember it being excruciating pain. And I think that's kind of what woke me up, because I was like in and out, in and out, in and out. My daughter says I wasn't fully paralyzed and sedated until 2 days after I was put on the ventilator. So you can imagine what that does to a person, not being, you know, fully sedated when you're on a ventilator. It's horrible. Okay. They kept asking me, do you remember anything? Do you remember anything? I would tell them no, because I was scared to death. I didn't want them to know that I had heard conversations and that, you know, I just didn't trust them. You know, I just had a bad feeling about it. And, I remember I must have been the 2 days where I wasn't sedated, because my daughter said this happened first. The first thing when I got to the hospital. Okay. So of course they're saying she has COVID. My first COVID test was a rapid test. When I got to the emergency department, it was negative. Okay. So I guess they gave me the other kind of test until they got a positive test, because I have been sick since April. Okay. I was much sicker in April than I was at the end of September, but I guess it just lingered on. You know, oxygen level drop, whatever. So anyway, my family, you know, were at the hospital. They were allowed to be at the first hospital. Okay. But then when I was transferred to the COVID unit in this next city over, they wouldn't let them come in. They didn't want them calling. They didn't want them, you know, they didn't want them contacting me at all. And actually, they had sent my cell phone with me, and my driver's license was taped to the back of my cell phone by the EMT. Do you know that they supposedly lost my cell phone and my driver's license? I have yet to get either of those things back from the hospital. The hospital said that wasn't their responsibility, even though I'm sedated, I'm ventilated, you know, I'm all these kind of things, like my belongings, whatever, doesn't matter. I don't know how you just lose a cell phone and your driver's license, but they did. Okay. Still not got those things back. Thinking back, it scares me, because they wouldn't let my family contact me. they didn't want my family to contact me via my phone or the hospital phone. And another thing that scared me was on my driver's license, I was not an organ donor. I just never, believed in that because I always felt that the organs wouldn't necessarily go to somebody that was unwealthy. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
I always just felt like, maybe there's a market, for body parts and such as that. So I was never an organ donor. But the strange thing is, I remember the doctor, my doctor, standing over to the right of me, and he had at least two nurses beside him. Now, mind you, I could barely even hold my eyes open. I didn't know where I was. I had no idea what was going on. And he said, "Mrs. Heron," and I looked at him and I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Is there any reason why we should continue to worry your family about your medical condition?" And I said, "Well, I don't want to worry my family about my medical condition." So he said, "Okay, that's good." He said, "Then I'll be over your care from this point forward." I didn't know what that meant. What it really meant was they had took my medical power of attorney away from my family while I was in the hospital.
Wow.
My husband calls. They tell him that I have took them off of my contact information, that I didn't want anyone to have any knowledge of my medical condition, what my updates were, or anything. Basically, I was in the hospital with nobody, no advocate is what it was. They had left me with no advocate. And I was like, "I don't understand this. You don't know what's going on." Well, luckily, for some reason, I woke up. They said I laid there after they took me off the ventilator. I laid there unresponsive for about 3 days. They did a CT to make sure I didn't have brain damage, and I didn't. I couldn't wake up because nothing was familiar to me. I didn't know. I had not heard a familiar voice. I had not seen my family in 21 days. Okay, 21 days. I had not heard my child call me mother. I had not heard my husband call my name, my grandkids, nothing. I didn't even know any of the nurses in the hospital, although it's, a local hospital. So I feel like, what Josh was saying is true. If the patients had someone there that they recognized their voice and, could kind of bring them out of stuff like that. But that was absolutely not allowed. Not allowed at all. Okay. So rocks around, here I am. I wake up, I'm cuffed to the bed. I have things on my legs. They said I had blood clots in my legs, but come to find out when I went to another hospital, that was never the case. But I was given medication for that. So anyway, I wanted to leave the hospital as soon as I could. And they told me this. They said, "Mrs. Heron, you're not going home. Your failure to thrive, you're like an 81-year-old woman," because I had lost about 80 pounds in the hospital within these 20 days. Okay. I needed to, but that wasn't how I wanted to do it. Okay. So I'd lost about 80 pounds. I had no muscle tone. I could not walk. I could not move. I had to learn to swallow again, had to learn to do everything again. Basically, they said, "You're just basically an invalid. And there's no family that's going to want to take care of you. They can't take care of you because you're too sick." And I was devastated. And I remember crying. I cried because I couldn't talk to my family and ask them if that was their wishes. So I just had to assume that they said, "I'm done with her, throw her away, whatever." So I'm in the hospital, I'm devastated, crying. I had one nurse, and she was a great nurse, and I loved her so much. And she would bring me my tray in the morning. I couldn't eat it because my hand is messed up, like paralyzed from the bad IV, I guess. So I couldn't open, and it was over my right hand. I couldn't open my pudding cups. I couldn't open my applesauce. And they would just bring it in there and just leave it for me to eat. And I couldn't because I couldn't even pick up a spoon. So I had this one nurse, and she was so nice. And she came in and she would feed me every morning. She would feed me, as long as she was there. She was so good to me. And I was crying that morning. And she said, "Darling, what's wrong?" And I said, "Well," I said, "my family doesn't want me." And she says, "Why do you say that?" And I said, "Well, the doctors told me that. They told me that I have to go to a long-term care facility because my family cannot take care of me." And she said, "Darling," she said, "don't you believe that?" She said, "Your family loves you and you don't need to be in a nursing home." And I said, "Well, that's what I thought too, but this is what the doctors are saying." And I remember the doctors telling me that. They told me I was not going home. My family was not going to take care of me. And I would be going to a long-term care facility as soon as they could find a placement for me there. I was devastated. Finally, my dad, he is an old security guard at the hospital, and maybe I guess he had some connections there. He called somebody. So the first time I was ever in touch with any of my family was when a security guard from the hospital was in my room, handed me the phone, and said, "Your family, your daddy wants to talk to you." That was the first communication I had with anybody. And I told my daddy, I said, "You have got to get me out of here. Y'all have got to get me out of here. Nobody has called, nobody's checked on me, and they're going to send me to a nursing home." And I begged him. I said, "Daddy," I said, "please get me home. Please send somebody for me." So from that point on, then I was allowed to have a phone call with my mother. She called the hospital phone. She told me what had happened. That was the first, it was the first I heard of it. I remember thinking it was the 80s because, I thought George Bush Sr. was still president. And I couldn't answer their questions to say who the current president was. So that was telling them that I was not, able to come home. Maybe I had some brain damage, whatever. So I remember talking to my mother, and she told me what had happened. And she said, she said, "You coded." She said, "You died." She said, "You've been away from us for a long time. And, we want you to come home." And I said, "But they're telling me that I can't come home, that I have to go to a long-term care facility." And my mother said, "No, baby, we're going to get you home." So it was a struggle. My family had to contract with a home health care agency and pay them, I think it was $1,200, to send in the paperwork to say that they would take care of me when I got home. The hospital didn't like that at all. They did not like that at all. But they were forced to do it once the home health care company tried to take my care over. But it's a terrible thing. I ended up with a MRSA. I think it was probably from the bad catheter. And so they let me come home. I was home for 2 days. I was so sick when I come home that I probably would have died had it not been for LifeFlight. I had to be flown out to another hospital. When I got to that hospital is when I learned that I had MRSA. Had a crazy high fever. And I knew that before I left the first hospital, I was having fever. And I would ask her, I said, "I really don't think this is normal that I'm having fever." And she was like, "Oh, it's no big deal. It's no big deal." Well, they let me come home with a fever. And when I got home, I was in respiratory failure because I did have MRSA and I did have something wrong. My lung had collapsed. So I was life flighted to another hospital. I get to another hospital. And their concern was that, they wouldn't treat me for COVID anymore because I was out of those days of COVID. So they were treating me for a collapsed lung and MRSA. And I stayed there probably 2 months I stayed there. I ended up with the procedure to clear my lung out, and I had two of those surgeries. The first time I had one drain tube in my lung, and the second surgery I had two drain tubes in my lung. So I guess I got over the pneumonia, but the after effect of the MRSA, the staph infection, I think that's what really just about killed me.
You're amazing. I mean, you were on a ventilator for 8 days. I mean, I haven't heard of very many people that were on a ventilator at all that survived. I mean, they pretty much kill everyone. So you're one lucky lady. So how are you doing now? Are you
I'm
100%
doing okay.
healthy?
No, I'm not 100%. I suspect I have long COVID, but I'm not, or long haul COVID, but I'm not going back to the doctor unless it's absolutely necessary.
Yeah.
I have come to fear the hospitals. I've come to fear the nurses, the doctors, and my sister's a nurse. And I've just come to lose most of the respect that I have for the hospital industry. And I feel like remdesivir, I had did some research on that before I was hospitalized. I talked to my family and I was like, this protocol that they have when you go in the hospital, it's to isolate you from your family, it's to start pumping you full of remdesivir, and pretty much just ease you on out of here and do whatever they want to do after that, with your organs or whatever. So I was like, if this ever happens to me, I was like, I'm just gonna have to refuse this remdesivir. I want y'all to re refuse it. Well, my family had told them that they did not want me to have remdesivir. Well, I, as soon as I hit the first emergency room, they were pumping me with remdesivir. Okay. I got two doses right within maybe 25 hours, I think it was. I had got two doses at the first hospital. They moved me to the second hospital to where I was put on the COVID unit. I got two more doses there. And my husband said, no more, do not give her any more remdesivir. I didn't want her to have any to start with. And so I didn't get that final dose of remdesivir. I don't know if that's what saved me. I really, people's prayers. I really don't know, but I had one nurse tell me, she said, she said, I guess you're my miracle. This has never happened before. And she said, honey, she said, you weren't supposed to make it. And that broke my heart. And I really didn't grasp the I don't know, the whole picture at that time, because I was just like in a daze here, in a daze there, in and out. But when I finally got home and started hearing the stories about how my family, pretty much wasn't allowed to advocate for me. They were just told to just go home. We'll call you if we need you. Don't be calling us. And I think, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No. So there's the what I'm get what we get out of a guest I've had on previously, and both of you, Josh and you both, is once. And I didn't have quite so much of that because Josh, I got to tell you, you're North Carolina is the only state I've heard that lets you have even 2 hours a day visiting with somebody in COVID. Usually, the hospital my brother was in.
I can't believe our liver.
Yeah, well, as you said, they had a law or something in North Carolina passed a law. What was it called again?
Yeah, it's called the No Patient Left Alone Care Act. And I can't believe our liberal governor signed that. He must have known somebody in the hospital or some liberals had some pull there because he doesn't sign anything else unless it's a veto.
Well,
I mean, he doesn't want anything good for us.
well, that's great because you at least, I
And
mean,
it
it's little consolation to you, but I can tell you that a lot of, like the woman I had on last week, she has not seen her husband in, God, I don't know, 20 some days, but he was in the same hospital as my brother was in. And there they have what's typical, a 21-day quarantine for COVID patients. So if my brother had lived that long, I could have seen him after, but he didn't live that long. It didn't take that long for their care to kill him. And so at least I'm amazed because I haven't heard any other state that had, because they, And she even said when she was finally able to visit him, because he's been in the hospital for as of last week, 58 days, I think, and has lost 52 pounds. Stephanie somehow lost 80 pounds. It's incredible. But when she was in the room, I don't know if you saw that, Josh, they actually had a person, I forget what she called her, but it was basically a watcher that came in to observe her. In fact, so if they didn't want her being alone with her husband. So let's say if I had been able to visit my brother, I would have snuck ivermectin in or something. They don't want that.
You know, I had the horse paste at the house and my wife wouldn't take it because she was pregnant. I knew I didn't even need to offer it to her because she wouldn't take it. And then at the hospital, you know, she was doing good before they put her on the ventilator. And I thought we were on the home stretch and I didn't want to get busted trying to sneak it into the hospital or have a problem. And then, you know, get kicked out and not have anything. But you talk about people losing weight. I would go in the hospital when my wife was on the ventilator and I would be like, hey, have y'all fed her today? Because,
yeah.
You know, you see the pump for the feeding machine and there's no little bottle of, you know, 1,000 cc's of nutrition that really ain't that nutritious. Mm-hmm. And then other days you go in after you said something about it. Some days they were like, well, we don't have any on this floor. And then other days you go in and it'd be hanging up and it wouldn't even be turned on. And I've heard from other people that, you know, they might feed you a little bit. They might not. They really don't care. I mean, it was
starving people. Jeez. Stephanie, how did you lose 80 pounds? How did you, they must not have been feeding you anything.
No, they couldn't have been feeding me anything.
No, 80 pounds.
80 pounds. They tried to say that when I was admitted to the hospital, my glucose levels were really high, and I'm sure they were because I was living off of NyQuil and Gatorade and, you know, never checking my sugar or whatever. I'm not a diabetic. I wasn't a diabetic when I went in the hospital. So they were also giving me insulin, and I think that was because, you know, the steroids had ran my blood sugar up, whatever. But oddly, this is what's so odd, okay? When I was reading over my medical charts, when I entered the emergency room at the first hospital, I was 280, okay? So that's how I knew I lost 280 pounds. Because when I got to the third hospital, I only weighed 201. Okay, but in my medical charts from the first hospital, they never changed my weight. My weight in their charts never changed from the time I got there until the time I left, but were absolutely different. My weight was absolutely different when I got to the third hospital, which was not a part of this first hospital system that I went to. So basically, when I woke up, I was starving, but I couldn't eat because my hand was injured, still can't use my right hand. It's like it's asleep, and I couldn't feed myself, but I was starving. And when I got home, my family, you know, they were cooking for me like every 2 hours. I can only eat a small amount of stuff at one time, like maybe some eggs. I really wanted some eggs and some strawberries. And I lived off eggs and strawberries while I was at home until I could get my weight. I had to drink Ensure to make sure that I could get some weight back on because I was just, you know, wasting away. My muscles were gone in my legs. My skin was just hanging, basically. And I did feel hungry, like I wanted food, but my stomach had shrank so much from not having anything that I couldn't eat that much at one time, just maybe like a small handful of eggs and strawberries, you know, and that was it. Like I'm talking about one handful with strawberries, maybe, you know, and eggs, not two different handfuls of each. But I was starved. I was starved. And but I guess after a while, you don't really realize it. And then when I remember crying when they would bring me my hospital tray, because it would be stuff like pudding that I couldn't open, ice cream that I couldn't open, apple juice that I couldn't open. And it's pretty much just like shoved there in front of you. And it's like, eat it if you can, if you can't, you know, to hell with you. Until that one nurse came in, like I said, and she started feeding me. And they had already put me down. One nurse told me, she said, "Honey, you're not ever going nowhere." She said, "You're just failure to thrive. You're just like an 81-year-old woman just here wasting away, ready to die." I was like, "What?" You know,
That is
like,
awful.
what? It's
Yeah, that's.
awful. But the worst thing, I think the worst thing that they said to me was when that doctor said, "If you don't quit fighting with us, I'm going to shove this tube back down your throat." And
Yeah, oh my gosh.
I remember her saying that. And what are you going to do? You're going to fight somebody that's telling you that. And I remember saying, "Please don't, please don't." And I think that's the time that she probably did, because, you know, when my daughter had called, she talked pretty bad to my daughter, and my daughter talked pretty bad to her. And she said, "I know you what you're doing up here. You know, you're killing people." And she said, "This is going to be one woman that you're not going to kill, because I'm going to have your effing job first thing in the morning." And my daughter was very forceful about it. And they did actually end up going up to the hospital, but they wouldn't let them in.
No.
And I'm pretty sure they would have called security had my family tried to go in there. And at
Yeah,
one point
yeah.
in time, I had one nurse to tell me that they actually had somebody stationed outside my room sitting in a chair to make sure nobody would come in my room.
Well,
Now,
that sounds like what the my guest last week, Lori, said that but they had someone in the room, because they wanted to see the interaction. And I said, what I said, first of all, aren't these hospitals claiming they're understaffed? They don't have enough workers. So was that a nurse? Who was that in there? Who are they paying to do that? And that can't be an isolated case. So I'm wondering how many other cases, when you're lucky enough. That's why I wondered, well, Josh was able to spend 2 hours there, but it sounds to me like you mentioned something similar to that, where you said they would wait to do things when you were there. And that's clearly, to me, indicates maybe they were trying to cut into your time, so you'd have even less time to see her. Well, we have to do this, So it's awful hearing this. And it's, again, it's, if you know my story, I wasn't able to see him at all in 2 weeks. And I didn't really get too much rudeness from the doctors and nurses, because I couldn't get a hold of them very much. They were very hard, and I had to call. That's all I could do. I couldn't go there in person. But Josh, how did you get to, because I need to do that. What was the procedure for you? It might be different in Virginia, to get your wife's medical record.
I went to the hospital, and I told them I wanted her records. And they got the COVID screening and the security stations you go to. They sent me over to a window, and they act like it was no big deal. I paid for the fee to get it put on a CD, because they told me it'd take too long to email it. And I was really surprised how easy it was to get, until I started reading the CARES Act and realized that they have zero liability. So I honestly think they don't care. I mean, some days I would check in at the hospital. Like, I would have to, the protocol was call in the morning. They'd call you back and tell you whether you can come or not. You had to be there at 4. You had to go through a screening. They had to, give you a name tag, and they were supposed to walk you up. And of course, I found out who the lady was over that, and I found out what kind of candy she liked, and I bought her a big bag of candy. So, I'd kind of get a little prioritized going in. But then you'd hear other people, and I didn't even say this out in public at the hospital, but they were like, it's easier to visit somebody in prison. And I mean, the people were serious. And it was crazy, because I'd go there, and it was like they always wanted to talk to me on my 2 hour time. And I'm like, that's my wife's time. And they'd have social workers come talk to me. And it was like they would try to break my spirit before I would go in there to see my wife. I mean, they literally, like, after my wife had the C-section, they told me to go home, don't worry about your wife, isolate for 10 days so you can be there for your baby. And I was just like, I was blown away. I was like, my child's going to the NICU. She's in good hands. I was like, my wife just had a C-section and had a baby. She needs me more than anything. And everybody just looked at me like I was crazy, except for the anesthesiologist. And that night, they didn't even want me to see my wife after she had the C-section. Of course, they didn't let her see our child. And it was insane. And I fought with all these people at the hospital. And when they finally marked, first, when my wife went in, she's like, she's going to be on isolation until she gets out of the hospital, plus I think 21 days. Then it was going to be, something else plus 21 days. And then it was going to be 21 days from the time she got admitted to the hospital. And then I got it down to 21 days from the time she tested positive, and then it was 21 days from her first symptom. But, I was doing my research and I was asking them, I was like, y'all have double standards here. Our baby was born from a COVID, as you say, COVID mother. Y'all won't do a COVID test. And she gets a COVID test within 24 hours, then 48 hours after being born. If she's negative on both of those, she goes into, I'd say it just like this. She gets out of solitary confinement and goes to general population
Yes.
after that 48 hours. And they kind of, the NICU nurses didn't know what to say when I said that. And then I was like, it's a joke. And they thought that was funny. But all the other staff was just like, they had no sense of humor on any of that stuff. And, I brought it to their attention that if I worked for this hospital system, and at the time, which 2 weeks after our baby got out, it was like, if you don't have symptoms, you don't even miss work. But at the time, it was, didn't matter how sick you are with COVID, 10 days from your first symptom, you're allowed to go back to work. I'm like, there's multiple standards, and everybody had the same scripted response. And I
Absolutely.
really, it was, you just got nowhere with these people. And then, you ask questions about what they're giving, or like, the Remdesivir blowed my mind, because like everybody that was like, why did you make her refuse that? That's like the only thing we have to treat this. And the internal medicine doctor finally called me back after I complained on him a couple times that he wouldn't return my phone call. And of course, they got an attitude with me and said, hey, he's only required to call one person every 24 hours. And I'm like, look, it's Wednesday. My wife's been in here since Sunday, and it's my wife. If he's calling anybody, he's going to be calling me. And I hadn't heard from him the whole time he's been here. And I've asked for a phone call every day. So he finally called me back, and he had an attitude. And of course, I called him out on it, and then he got more of an attitude.
Yeah.
And he was mad that I had to refuse a Remdesivir, and he wanted to know why. And I started explaining, the World Health April 2021 research, where, what was it, 93 out of 175 people died. I mean, the research is written, so it looks great, except for that one figure, which is awful. And he's like, and I was like, it's only emergency use approval at the time. And he got all mad, and he's like, you think we can just prescribe whatever we want to, and this, that, and the other? And he basically told me he was just following orders. And so, I asked him, well, who are your orders from, basically? And he's like, well, we follow a board, a medical board. And I was like, what medical board is that? And I stood there on the phone in silence for probably 45 seconds to a minute before I said, it's a real simple question. It's not hard to answer. What medical board do y'all follow? And he told me American Board of Internal Medicine. And it's just amazing. I mean, at the hospital, my wife was on an intermediate care floor first, and it was awful. I've seen better care in a nursing home. They didn't want to go in the rooms. They didn't want nothing to do. They make me put on a gown and a mask and all this other BS. It's all a joke. I mean, if you look at the size that a mask filters out and the size of the particle they claim. But every floor, it would be COVID patient, non-COVID patient. Every other room would be a non-COVID patient everywhere she went. And then in the intermediate care, they had fans in the window sucking the air out through a filter, so they were kind of negative pressure. But in the ICU, I kind of wandered off one day on the way out. Every room has negative pressure ventilation available, but every single one of them was turned off. And I was sure, the first week my wife was there, I was calling everybody I knew in town, trying to find a patient advocate lawyer that would stand up against this hospital system. Nobody wanted to touch it. I was talking to friends of friends that were physicians and everything else. I was trying to get, help on, somebody that would sign her out. I had no idea, even being in the medical field, I could have got my wife to refuse treatment, and they would have to let her leave the hospital, and they would be required to, provide oxygen for her to go home with. But unfortunately, I just had no idea. And I thought, I knew it was a bad idea going to the hospital, but I thought if I was there to advocate and stay on top of these people, I thought we would persevere. And I thought they'd have a little sympathy, being my wife was pregnant. But there was one really good doctor. There was a couple really nice nurses. Most of the people I dealt with were, I mean, they were honestly burnt out. And that's That's what they see every day because that's what they push. So, they just think everybody that gets COVID is going to die.
I
And,
agree. Yeah, that, well, that, yeah, that, that's what people have asked me all the time. Well, you think there's a, of course, I do believe, obviously, my, you know, as my writing indicates, I believe that we're being run by conspirators. So, yeah, I believe in conspiracies. But I don't think that nurses and doctors are willfully setting out to kill people when they come in, but they're following the protocol. It's killing, and they don't question it. And that's the thing, is the protocol is killing people. And I said, I don't know about what either of you think, but I don't know, Josh, especially you, I don't know how you feel about what would happen if your wife had never gone to the hospital. But in my case, I know my brother would be alive and well today because he had no symptoms at all. He went for an unrelated cause, and they gave him a COVID test as soon as he walked in. Told him, I'm sure the first question they asked is, are you vaccinated? And when he said no, they fast-tracked him. No question in my mind about it. And, you know, the PCR tests are 90% false positive anyhow. So they're meaningless. And they took a healthy guy,
well,
who's very healthy.
My wife was in there in December.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Josh.
My wife was in there in December, and they recalled the PCR test. And what was they recalled the PCR test in July. And, you know, the recall didn't take effect till what, December 31st. And now they're still using them. And they're talking about how great this stuff is. The problem is with the physicians, they have due diligence to do research on this stuff on their own to know what the stuff is going to cause and to prescribe. And they're supposed to give, inform the patient on what they're giving and what the side effects are. And there's none of that. They're not informing the patients of the side effects or anything else or you know, other options. I mean, through my research now and knowing what I know about some other stuff, you know, if your oxygen goes down because of the COVID and all this other stuff, why aren't they putting people in hyperbaric chambers? I mean, your oxygen can be like in the 60s and you get in a hyperbaric chamber, you know, one atmosphere, two atmosphere, and your oxygen on just regular air is going to skyrocket.
Well, if you had, in your wife's case though, she was sick. So let's just say, do you feel that if you had not gone to the hospital, of course, the problem with you is that your situation, she was pregnant, about to deliver a baby. So unless you had delivered it at home, you're going to have to go somewhere to have the baby. So, but do you feel that, you know, when you went to the hospital, that was it? I mean, if she hadn't gone to the hospital, do you think the hospital killed her?
My wife was 31 weeks pregnant. So she was 2 months early. I think if I could have weathered it through that Sunday night, I look back and think about all the stuff I could have done different, and it's really hard. And, you know, I wish I'd have just called an ambulance service and got her some oxygen and, you know, went to the bank, maxed out my Visa or whatever on ATM and, you know, bribed them to leave the oxygen tank overnight or, you know, I mean, after my wife was in the hospital, I didn't work while she was in the hospital. I did research and called people and called on the hospital and everything else. There was a ton of different options that would have been better. If I would have signed her out earlier, oh yeah, it would have been great. I mean, I've had other people look at it and they just talk about not only the gross negligence, but you know, they gave my wife the remdesivir after she said she didn't want it. They told her it was an antibody infusion. She thought she was getting the monoclonal antibodies. It's just crazy.
Well, all three of our cases,
how they're doing this.
It is. Well, in your
Pardon?
Case, in all three of our cases, they gave the remdesivir to my brother behind my back. I didn't find that out until later when I told him early on, no remdesivir, and they did it. He consented because he didn't know what was going on. That's what happens to a lot of people. They gave it to your wife even though you didn't want it, and Stephanie got it even though she didn't want it. So obviously remdesivir is key here. You know, this is obviously, it's very lucrative, and I've heard figures. I don't know, I've heard that they make $100,000 off of COVID death. And I can believe it because they're pushing this really, really hard.
Yeah. You know, thankful that, you know, when you get your medical, you know, when you get a bill, it's broken down, you know, and you can see what the charges are for these things. And this remdesivir drug that they gave me, I think it was like $6,900 a dose.
Yes, yes, yes.
Is, you know, what, and I just... $6,900, Like that's that's a lot of money.
Very, very lucrative. Yes, you can
And
see why they push that instead of ivermectin, you can buy cheaply and it
that's
has a much better track record.
exactly right. And
Yeah.
if the protocol is five doses, it's $6,900. I mean, not a mathematician, but that's quite a hefty bit of money, for just probably what, 5 minutes worth of work.
Yeah,
To
well, you
push
know,
this.
with the
Go ahead, John.
remdesivir, it come out for Ebola, and it failed, and it never got approved for that. And then after that, it failed, I believe, four times with the FDA, and then they give it emergency use approval. And then the World Health Organization, even on corrupt Google, you can go in and type WHO remdesivir April 2021, and you read the study, and it's written in such a way that it's like, oh, it don't look too bad. And then you go over to the third column, and then, I think it was 93 out of 175 people died from multiple organ failure or kidney failure. Some people even got kidney transplants. I mean, it's everything right now with the COVID, it's financially incentivized. Financially incentivized diagnosis, financially incentivized treatment, and that's never good for the patient. That's never, ever good for the patient.
No.
And that's why they're pushing it and the pressure. The doctors and nurses, there's some renegades out there. Last couple of weeks, I've had renegade nurses on my show who they can't go work at a hospital ever again because they're nobody's going to hire them because of what they're talking about. They're against the protocol. They understand how dangerous the protocol is, but if you're there, you have to follow the protocol. So the doctor that goes against it, well, I guess he's not going to be able to practice medicine at least there. And a nurse, obviously, a lowly nurse that's questioning this, who do you think you are? And they treat them probably similar to the way they treated both of you. And that's I've been in that situation myself. The first instance where the smiles go away is when you start questioning. The veneer comes off right when you start, especially if you display a little knowledge. If you talk about remdesivir, ivermectin, and all that, so they know they got one that can think here, they can see, and so they don't like that. So their arrogance really comes out in full force.
Absolutely.
I had printouts every day, and they'd question me on stuff, and I'd hand them the research. They'd be like, just read it. Just Google any of
They
these
don't want
researches
that.
and see what it says.
Yeah.
No, they didn't
Yeah.
like that.
No, they don't
That's
like
not.
to be questioned. They don't like for a family to contact them. It's almost like they can't be bothered, with talking to
Yes.
the family because the
Yes.
family, they really don't care about the family. And, if they're standing over you and they have gotten your medical power of attorney from you by just saying what those
Yeah.
words were, do we need to, is there any reason to continue to worry your family? Who wants to worry their family? And I'm like, no, I don't want to worry my family. So that's how they're doing that. That's how they're getting people's power of attorney. They don't want them to talk to their family. They don't want them to have an advocate so they can do whatever the hell they want to do with them when they get them there in that hospital. And I will tell anybody to this day, I feel like I was medically kidnapped and held against my will at the hospital. That's exactly how I feel. I can't help feeling that way, but that's the way I feel.
Well,
And
you,
I'm.
Stephanie, you said you've been sick since April. So I guess you just finally got fed up with it and probably made a mistake in your eyes. So what do you feel? How do you feel you would be doing today if you'd never gone to the hospital?
I think I would have recovered because I only had one lung that was affected. We have two lungs. I could have probably lived with the other lung just fine. I was more sick in April as far as my energy, couldn't get my breath, couldn't stand up to brush my teeth. So in September, I had been taking NyQuil, I had been taking Gatorade because I just, I felt bad. Like I had muscle aches, kind of like the flu. I didn't really have a cough. I really wasn't short of breath that I knew of up until the last day. That's why I called a friend of mine and I told her, I said, she was an EMT, and I said, I really, really, really do not want to go to the hospital. I'm not sure that I have COVID, but I really don't want to go to the hospital. I know I'm dehydrated. If you could just come by here in the ambulance and just give me some fluids and then, just go on your way or whatever, I don't need to ride to the hospital. But when she got here, My oxygen level was 68.
Oh, terrible. Wow.
Yeah,
Wow.
but I really didn't know it. I was still up walking around. I had got in the tub to take a bath that day because I knew I was going to the doctor or something. I told my mom, I said I just got to go somewhere. So she had come down here and she had got me in the tub. But then when my husband got home, an hour later, I couldn't get out of the tub. So they both had to get me out of the tub. And that's when I knew how sick that I was. So I was only sick like, a couple of hours, really bad sick. But then my oxygen level was 68. And she said, honey, she said, IV's not going to help you. She said, you're in respiratory distress and we've got to get you to the hospital. And I said, well, okay, if that's what it has to be. And it just from the time I got there, I was adamant about, I just want to be sent home with hospice. If I'm this sick, I don't know how I can be this. I was shocked that I was that sick when I got to the hospital because they're telling my family she's probably not going to make it. There's only 15% chance she's going to make it. And I'm hearing all this, and I'm like, well, what's the point in putting me on a respirator if I'm that sick already? What's the point in drawing this thing out? I said, just send me home with hospice. That's what I want. Well, we hem-hawed around about it, for probably, I guess, 30 minutes, an hour. And the doctor at the first emergency room, he was very aggressive with me. He would stand over me, almost preaching to me, like, why do you not want this? Like, what is the problem? Like, you need to be on a ventilator. You need to let us do this. And my daughter was in there and she had to intervene. And she said, hey, she was like, my mama's sick. She probably doesn't even know what she's saying. Can you just give her a minute to process all this? And I was like, thank you. I have a minute to think about this. And so I guess he came back in a little bit later. And when I finally said, okay, if it's necessary, then you have to do that, that's fine. His whole demeanor changed toward me, where I had been sitting in the emergency room for hours. All of a sudden, when I said, yes, I'll go on a ventilator if necessary, they found me a room in 15 minutes.
It's,
15 minutes, okay,
amazing.
once I said, yes, I'll do that. And once I got there, it was fast tracked. Once they got my medical power of attorney away from my family,
Sure,
they fast
sure.
tracked me into everything that they could do. There's
The
no telling how
protocol.
much. Yeah, it was the protocol. Another thing too is I think a lot of the nurses maybe I had were travel nurses, so they didn't really have a community connection there and wouldn't
Right.
have known the family or a person that was a patient there like the locals would have because I didn't know anybody there. Some of them had such strong accents, I couldn't even
Yes.
understand them. I couldn't even
Yeah.
understand what they were saying. But it's just I mean, I really don't know how I was spared. I feel so lucky and so blessed every day. But apparently, I did give them, a pretty good fight in the hospital.
Yeah, I'll say you must
Yeah.
have. I mean, gosh, you're under those circumstances, but you bring up a point about some of the nurses having accents and everything. I worked in for the medical industrial complex my entire life. I was fired 4 years ago on a right to work day for helping out a handicapped coworker because they were trying to ease out the people in IT that had been there a long time. They didn't want to pay us the money. And they were bringing in visa workers, and they were doing the same thing. And I think I wonder if Josh can touch on this, what his experience was. I started noticing already when I would have to, I worked at a remote location, but when I would go back to one of the hospitals to do something, I noticed how things had changed. How there were lots and lots of obvious immigrant doctors and nurses everywhere. And I don't think this is an accident because I believe they're, first of all, they're paying them less money, just like they're paying any other. This is why it's so popular. But I wonder if you mentioned, Stephanie, you obviously saw that. Josh, did you notice anything like that when your wife was in the hospital?
Actually, the only doctor that I had respect there in the dealing with my wife was he was an Indian guy and he was on it. I mean, he was with me on making the decision to do the C-section early against the advice of the OB. The OB was like, basically like, if you do this, this is all on you. And he coming to me and he's like, look, babies aren't my thing. I work in the ICU. He didn't really say he was really either way, but I felt like talking to him that he was, agreeing with me. And then the next day he come in and saw how my wife was doing, and he told us we made the right decision, and he was so happy for us. And then, that weekend he's off shift and we're dealing with other people.
Right,
Yeah.
right.
Well, I mean,
So
it's not to mention. I mean, I didn't mean it to say that that necessarily means that they're going to give you worse care because, again, I go back a long way with the medical industrial complex, and certainly when there were no immigrant doctors and nurses, the care was very questionable, to say the least, and I was critical of it then. I don't think anybody else was, but it does bring up what Stephanie talks about. It's another unnecessary glitch when you throw in there a communication problem, because you're already having a hard time. You're dealing with arrogance, and now you're dealing with an inability to understand each other. And again, that's a kind of a different issue, but it doesn't help things here.
No, absolutely not. And that was what my daughter's problem was with the my nurse that I was assigned was she couldn't understand her. She would talk so fast with such a strong accent that they couldn't really understand what she was saying. And she basically said, "Look, I can't understand you. My daddy can't hear good, so he certainly can't understand you. And you're going to have to give us somebody that can, make us understand a little bit better than you." So then that's when they had to put my doctor on the phone, and she had a little bit better English than my nurse did, but they were still not very fluent in English. And that makes it really hard.
Yeah,
We
absolutely.
have a, from the South here especially, we have strong Southern accents, and they made no attempt to, I guess you say, dumb themselves down to us. It was just the words, the accents we couldn't understand, and that seemed to be convenient for them.
Well, sure. I mean, first of all, they don't want to really have a conversation with you. Both of you realize that because they want to tell you something in as few words as possible, as brusque as they can be, and they're gonna tell you what they're gonna do, and they're not used to very many people questioning that. We're used to people saying, okay, whatever. They're not, and so when they run into people like you, there's wait a minute, that arrogance is gonna come out, that resistance is gonna come out, and they certainly don't want you throwing it, Josh, when you're showing him studies and all that, they definitely don't want to see that. It's like, oh
No.
my, that you're a nightmare for him. What? That's not science.
I went in one day and I asked the nurse, I was like, yeah, I want to update. And they're like, and I heard this same response a few times. Well, tell me what you know and I'll fill in the blanks. And I'm like, talk to me like I don't know anything and tell me what you know. And then like, I carried a notebook. I was writing down everything I could. They restricted me on information. I'm going through my wife's medical reports right now. And just for her stay, it's like 638 pages. And it's not the way it's done. It's not easy to follow. I mean, I got to go get this stuff printed out because it jumps all over the place. And it's just, I mean, it's unbelievable. And the stuff I've learned since I've been there and the stuff I learned while I was there, it was crazy. I mean, it was unbelievable.
I just never understood how the keeping you away from your family was really scientifically necessary because I had caught the COVID from my husband. He had already recovered from COVID. And for me not to be able to be around him when you share the same bed with someone, you eat all the meals together, you brush your teeth from the same toothpaste container, and then all of a sudden now they're saying, "Oh, you can't be around this person because you could catch COVID." Well, that was not a concern for my husband because he had already had COVID. That's where I got it from. We shared a home, we shared a life. He wasn't worried about that, but they still didn't care. They were just like, "Oh, you just can't be here." And to me, that's the worst part of it all is how they isolate you from your family. And it's a plan. It's not by a mistake that they do that. That's part of the protocol is to isolate people from their advocates. And that's how they're successful in doing the things that they do. And I totally believe that.
Absolutely.
It's psychological warfare.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you know, even before this began, I remember arguing, years ago, just why do you have visiting hours anyhow? You should be able to visit your loved one whenever you want, unless they, you know, say, I don't want him in here or something. Mm-hmm. But if you want to be with each other, as Josh talked about, it's very important. Of course, you're going to heal better if you have
Absolutely.
A loved one around you. So, I mean, I have to live with every day knowing that if I could have been there and seeing what was happening with my brother, but I couldn't. If
no.
I had, I could have looked at his charts. I could have gotten some idea of what's happening here. Why is he spiraling down? And I could have been questioning him in person, but I didn't get that chance. And I don't think that's an accident. They didn't necessarily know they had somebody like me that would question them, but they don't want anybody there because it's easier. And how many old, really old people over 80 or whatever that are coming in there? We know that first of all, they're expecting them to die if they get COVID. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, what do you expect?
Right.
And
right.
They're by themselves. And how many of them are even have all their senses, their faculties? So
right.
you think they're going to question remdesivir or something? Of course, I mean, they're not even going to know what's going on, and their families aren't there to try to monitor.
And I couldn't understand that, how I was laying there as sick as I was. I couldn't even talk to my family on the phone. But I remember being in the hospital, and it was during Halloween. It was, you know, October 31st was the time I was in the hospital, I guess the sickest. And I remember hearing kids playing out in the hall. Okay. I thought, are those like my grandkids? And no, they were not my grandkids. Apparently, they were the children of some of the staff up there because the nurse had come in and said they were having a Halloween party and hope that didn't disturb me. But it did disturb me because I'm out here hearing children running up and down the hall in a COVID unit. And I'm in here thinking, if this is so contagious, why do people have their children up here? But I could not for the life of me understand how that could be possible. So there's two different narratives here. There's one that they put out, and there's one that they follow personally. And it's like, do as I say, not as I do. Your family's not going to be here. You know, I just thought it was so sad that I was able to hear the voices of other kids running and laughing in the hall, and they weren't my family. So it's not about
yeah.
safety, or else they wouldn't have had their family up there for the Halloween party. And another
no.
thing, they come in there and they were dressed in Halloween outfits. And I guess they really don't realize, or maybe they don't care what that does to a person who is coming off of the medications that they put you on. Because that is something else, too, that people fail to talk about. Is the detox that has to come after you come off the ventilator. You know, you're on propofol, you're on, what is the fentanyl? You're on fentanyl, you're on morphine, you're Ativan, all these kind of things. And then all of a sudden you're not anymore. And I remember seeing bugs and shadows and witches and all kinds of things in my room at night. Like it was horrible. And they wore their Halloween costumes in my room. So you can imagine looking up, seeing your respiratory therapist with a black shirt on with ribs that glow in the dark. That's the kind of stuff that I went through. It was horrible, horrible, horrible.
Oh my.
And I remember crying. And when I got home, I even told my family, I said, my physical therapist was Diablo himself. You know, I can remember because, you know, his ribs were glowing and they were like, what? And now that, you know, I'm able to think about it more, it was Halloween and that was his costume. But just stuff like that, like, I guess I don't think about it. But when you're in a state like that, it's mental torture, the sounds that you hear and the things that you see. And I guess that's why they kept asking me, Mrs. Heron, do you remember anything? Do you remember anything? And I would always say no. No, because I didn't want them to know what I had heard and what I had saw and what I had witnessed, that I even remembered it. But they were very aggressive with me, very aggressive with me. Mm. And it's disturbing. I don't know if they treat everybody like that. Now, I did have one good nurse, and I told her my situation. I said, look, I'm scared. I said, I'm scared of these people. I don't feel like they've got my best interest at heart. Please don't leave me. And I begged her, I said, please don't leave me, because she was I had I was to the point to where I was wearing a diaper, okay? And some of the nurses had got on to me because I soiled my diaper. Well, I couldn't help that. I couldn't walk, I couldn't move, I couldn't do anything. And but she never did. She was so nice to me. And I remember telling her on a Saturday, I said, she was off on Sundays, and I said, I don't want to be here without you. I feel like they're going to do something to me, because I was paranoid every time they'd come in. I thought, what are they going to do? And
Well,
she
what a
said,
what
I'm
a
going.
horrible but what a horrible indictment, isn't it, that you were and I've got people in the chat room that are reacting to this and talking about their own issues and everything and saying how scared they are to go to hospital. Why, this is you talk about a scandal. Why,
Yes.
but before even COVID began, one of the best kept secrets in this country was that the hospitals and doctors, medical mistakes, were the third leading cause of death in America. Before this began, now I submit to you because of what happened to me and what I'm hearing from people like you, that I bet you now because they're not acknowledging all the people they've killed with their protocols and also the vaccine deaths they're not acknowledging either, that the medical industry is probably the number one killer in the country right now. We're number three before, and I don't know if you guys know, but one of the I think most of the important statistic I've heard in my life that's just being completely ignored is that the insurance companies are incensed because the death rate last year went up 40% for people between ages 18 to 64. 40%. That's an aberration the world has never heard of before, and outside of a war, and it's not attributable to COVID. Even their imaginary statistics have people like my brother dying of COVID. It obviously didn't, but there's so many like that, people in motorcycle accidents that they put COVID on the net. Even if you put all this together and whatever their official figures are, it doesn't come close to being responsible for a 40% increase. So there's something huge going on. I don't know how long they can cover this up, but they're doing a good job of it so far.
And that's the thing too, because I have reached out. I have some long-term disability that I'm right-handed. I can no longer use my right hand, and I feel like that's a result. I've talked to I have a deep tissue massage therapist that comes, and she seems to think that is that my hand being inoperable is because of the bad IV that I had in there. And you try to contact an attorney, and they're like, I've had attorneys say, what city is that in? I tell them the city, and they're like, oh no, there's no way we could get a jury up there to hear your case, because they're just too conservative. That's just too much of a conservative area that would even fathom these things happening in a hospital, because the people they know are nurses, their families are nurses. That's an admirable career to have, and they're just not going to believe these things that you're saying, and that your injuries were a result of a bad IV. I'm not saying all nurses are bad, but some of these nurses don't need to be nurses, okay? And the one nurse that I had that was really good, I'm hope one day that I'm able to, get back in contact with her, because I did beg her. I said, please don't leave me here. I'm terrified. And I had thoughts of jumping out the window. I had thoughts of, holding my knife back off my lunch tray and taking it to them. Like, that's how scared I was. It's like being in hell. Has to be. It's dark. Everything's dark. Everything's like a nightmare. And you just have a sense of evil. That's what I had a sense of, that there were evil people around me that meant to do me harm, and that I never slept. I would sleep in the daytime because I was so scared of the nurses at night. On the night shift, I would just sleep in the daytime, maybe 2 or 3 hours. And so I had this one nurse, and I told her these concerns. And she said, I'm not gonna let them hurt you, I promise. And I said, okay, but you're off tomorrow. Tomorrow's Sunday, you're gonna be off, and they'll probably kill me tomorrow, And I thought, I'll be dead by Monday. That'll be the last time I see her. And apparently my plea to her was what, had touched her in some way, because Sunday morning she came in, and she wasn't supposed to be there. And I said, I thought you weren't coming today. And she said, she said, I got home and she said, I sat in my car and she said, I thought about, what you said. And she said, I cried. She said, I cried and I cried. And she said, I've been so uneasy all night long. I've been worried. And she said, I just had to come in. She said, I just had to come and make sure that you were okay. And I wonder if maybe she's the reason that, I'm still here, because she was my inside advocate. And when you have a nurse that can't leave her job at work, at when you leave, you don't leave your mind, the things in your mind, but something had weighed so heavily on her that she showed up when she wasn't even on the schedule to show up that Sunday. And I really appreciate her. And to me, that's the kind of nurses I want to remember. I don't want to remember those that are threatening to put a tube down my throat or snatching on me or pulling on me or laughing at me when I asked to go to the bathroom. Even that happened. I had one nurse that laughed at me when I tried to get up to go to the bathroom. She said, "You can't walk. You can't walk. You've got a diaper on. Just go ahead and use it in your diaper." But then if I did, then they would snatch me around because they were mad because I had messed my diaper up.
Yeah, I don't know
So
that. And that's again, that's something I noticed inside. As far as and you had and there are great nurses like the one you had, but there are too many that aren't that would get mad at you for using a bedpan or whatever. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I had loved ones in the hospital that. If they needed a bedpan, they would make them wait so long. I mean, I don't know what, if they wanted to be going to bed or what. It used to drive me crazy, but I don't understand that. But unfortunately, that's kind of a part of the industry that's never acknowledged. But I want to, Stephanie, it seems like your family sounds like you had some good support and they understand what's going on. But too many families don't. Josh, obviously, I don't know if you were a skeptic before about all this, but you certainly are now. You're questioning things. How is the rest of your family? I don't know how big your family is, whether you have siblings, your wife's family, siblings, parents, or anything like that. How do they, are they on board with you? Do they think the hospital did something wrong with your wife? Or are they buying, like most of my family, except for my son who's awake, most of them think he died of COVID and he wasn't vaccinated. They buy the nonsense. I haven't influenced anybody, but how's your extended family doing?
So most of them know that it was gross negligence or financial incentivized murder. My wife's one of her aunts runs a cardiologist, and she was like, "You need to get a lawyer." And of course, they're all like, "With the CARES Act, until that gets repealed in North Carolina, that because it's unconstitutional." You're on hold until it gets repealed.
Well,
I
that's the
mean,
same thing.
it's
Yeah, well, that's well, at least you don't have people ostracizing you that's saying, you're crazy. They did all they could. What are you talking about? The doctors and nurses are great people. You don't have anybody in your family doing that?
I had that for a while, and then it's kind of changed some. I don't know. It was like I talked to people, and because I was reaching out to while my wife was in the hospital, and through December, I was reaching out to all kinds of people trying to, see who could help me. And everybody thought I was crazy, like, Alex Jones conspiracy theory type
Yes,
stuff.
yeah,
And then it was weird. I didn't really go out in January because my baby come home from the NICU, and she wasn't even due yet. So I didn't really go out and do anything in January. Didn't work. And then February I start back working, and everybody wants to see baby pictures, and then they ask questions, and then they find out. And you mentioned the R word, remdesivir, and then everybody already knows, and they're all like freaking out. And it was literally like it was literally like from last year to February of this year, it was like I woke up on a different planet because everybody's thoughts were different. And I think it's because people know people that have had to deal with that. And I don't know. I mean, I was looking at some numbers today, and it looked like only slightly less than 1 million people died of COVID in the US. But it's I don't know. People are more awake to this now, I believe, than ever. But the problem is you turn on the TV and it's straight up propaganda. I
And,
mean, it's everywhere. It's gaslighting. I mean, I can't even watch TV. It's just offensive. I just see right through all the stuff now, and it blows me away.
And I've had people to ask me, well, now how do you feel about getting the vaccine? How do you feel about it? And I'm like, I feel the same about it as I did before I got sick. And that's that it's not a true vaccine. It is a medical treatment, it's a medical experiment, and I will not take it. And I have not taken it, and I won't take it. And that's why when I got to the hospital and I thought they're going to start pushing because they were asking, are you vaccinated? Are you vaccinated? Are you vaccinated? Sometimes I told them yes, sometimes I told them no. Just to gauge their response. And if you say no, well, you're going to need to get vaccinated. Your family's going to need to get vaccinated. And I had already decided when I told them I wanted hospice that I was going to die. And I was not going to take the vaccine. I had rather die a quick death than a slow death from the side effects of a treatment, a medical treatment that nobody knows what the long-term effects of it are.
That's right.
And
That's
people ask me, well, have you changed your mind? No, absolutely not. If anything, I'm more adamant about not taking it than I was before because it's proven fact that you cannot trust what the FDA says, what your government tells you. And I hate to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but after a certain time and everything comes true, then you're really not a conspiracy theorist.
no.
And so I'm just, in my community, I run a Facebook page. I have about 8,500 followers, and I do another little radio show in my community, and I have a lot of followers on that. And I tell them the same thing. Look, they're like, well, is COVID real? I don't really know. I don't really know if COVID is real. I just know that the protocol that they use for it in the hospital has killed people and will continue to kill people because of the cocktail, the drug cocktails that they give you. And because, they isolate you from your family, why else would they not want your family to be around? I mean, there's something up.
Exactly.
It's, if they're not hiding anything, then why do they not want your family there? Because everybody knows if you're in the hospital and your family comes to visit, that gives the nurses a break from watching after you and from having to answer the call button. So, and that's another thing, you mash the call button when you're in the hospital. I've done it 4 or 5 times. I've waited 4 hours to go to the bathroom before.
Oh,
Four
yeah.
hours.
Yep.
And
And they want
I just,
another. I mean, nurses are almost like they're not quite to the level of teachers in terms of good and undeserved press that they get. But you're not going to hear too much criticism of nurses, like you're not going to hear criticism of certainly or teachers are the same. Yeah, Josh, I didn't ask you, was your wife vaccinated?
No, she was not. And with the Pfizer documents that come out a couple of weeks ago, I'm glad she didn't when she was pregnant. And honestly, when the OB walked into the room, that was the first thing he said was, best thing you could have done is took the shot when I offered it 3, 4 months ago, quote unquote. And I was blown away. And I told my buddies about it, and they're like, how did you not knock this guy out? And I was like, man, I prayed for discernment before I went in. I knew I'd be kicked out of there and wouldn't be able to advocate for my wife. But I don't know. I mean, it was, when they try to force something on you and then tell you, oh, you got to get this and you got to get this, and then they're gonna pay you to get it. Oh, if they got to pay me $100 to get something, I probably don't want it.
No,
No.
and that's what this whole thing is. That anybody who has studied this to any extent for a long time has looked at this and said, I worked in the medical industrial complex. I saw it up close. I saw the sausage being made. And you just, Anybody that thinks that the medical industrial complex cares about your health, I mean, everything they do is to the contrary. Otherwise, the big meme going around was perfect. There's so many great memes that capture these things, but one of them was that if they, if they're giving out free vaccines, why aren't they giving out free chemotherapy
Free
and
insulin.
insulin? Exactly, for insulin. And obviously, they don't. People die because they can't afford medical care all the time. People go bankrupt from medical bills. And that's something I want to ask you about, Stephanie. I believe you told me you've never gotten a bill. And and after I'm starting to tie this together because my brother, they forgave his remaining bill, then they forgave a small bill I've owed for years. I don't think that's a coincidence because they'll hound you to the ends of the earth for $50. This is part
Absolutely.
of, I think, the practice. They think if they can give people something, they'll feel a little, okay, maybe they'll be less likely to question what they did to their loved ones. Oh, okay, well, they paid, it's nice they waived the bill, right? I mean, it's so, and I find that amazing. You were in the hospital for 45 days, right? That's quite a medical bill you should have.
That's exactly right. See, the first hospital that I went to, they never ever sent me a bill. I never got one. We would check the mailbox, and you would get little bills like maybe from a independent physician and an X-ray company, blah blah blah. But I never really got
Lab
a bill.
work.
Yes,
Yeah.
lab work, yeah. And you get the little bills, and I was like, these big bills, they've got to be coming in, sometime soon. They never came. My bill never came. So I had this idea one day. I said, I remember setting up a My Chart account through this hospital at one point in time, maybe 5 years ago. And I said, I'm wondering if I can access that and just see what's going on with my bills and what's going on my records, what's going on with my tests, because you can get your test results in there. So I logged on, finally got on, and come to find out, I look on there and I think my bill was 700 and something thousand dollars. And this was just for 20 days of care, and it was $765,000, I think. And then I looked to the bottom, and the balance was zero. It was a
You have
zero
good
balance.
insurance, Stephanie. You must have the best insurance I've ever heard of.
Right. I know, right? And I looked at the top, and it said that it had been paid for by the COVID Care Act or something like that. And I was like, this is weird because they don't even send you a notice that your bill has been paid. You don't get a bill, you don't get a notice it's been paid. I had to log my chart to see that my bill was 100% paid. Everything was paid. I didn't owe one single dollar for my, and I'm thankful for that. I really am because I would be
Sure.
financially ruined if that was
Right.
okay. There's
And
no way.
if even if you weren't questioning your medical care, you would be ecstatic. Wow, how generous they are. This is a pretty cool system we have here. What are these Don Jeffries types criticizing? They're nuts. Josh, how about, have you had any kind of experience with your wife's bills?
I haven't got any major hospital bills yet. But we're all paying through this through our tax dollars because these hospitals aren't doing like elective cardiac procedures that make all the money, and they're all showing record profits.
Oh,
So they're just
absolutely.
robbing us. The government's paying them off. I mean, if you look at all these details and do any amount of research at all, it's like all this stuff's manufactured, and they have to have these people die so that the planademic continues. And then, Ukraine, and then everything disappears.
Well, and you're right, and they, but what they're doing, I think, is it's obvious to me, is that they're getting so, like, if they make $100,000 off somebody, like my brother or your wife, that's the average they make off of a so-called COVID
It's got to
death.
be way more than that. It's got to be
Yeah,
more than that. I've heard rumors that they get a 22% bonus off of giving remdesivir.
yes.
22% over the complete hospital bill.
Right, so we don't even know because we have no way of knowing. So, but just imagine how lucrative this were, and so they can afford to be. And again, the average person is not going to be questioning this. The average person is a sheeple, obviously, and they're going to go along with this, and they're going to think, "Oh, this is awful. My loved one caught this." Yeah, exactly. My loved one caught this awful, deadly virus, COVID, and this is terrible. There's nothing we can do about it. It's tragic. But look, they forgave their bill. Or they, you know, it's nobody questions. They never forgive cancer bills or heart disease bills or any people's bills that roll up that were in the hospital or were paralyzed or something, were in there for months. They never forgive a penny of those bills. Why are they doing it here? Obviously, they have a vested interest because they want to keep this thing going and they don't want people questioning it.
Yeah, they don't want anybody to rock
Well,
the boat or.
it's funny.
Go ahead, Josh.
It's funny you mentioned chemotherapy and cancer, because when chemotherapy was originally FDA approved, it was FDA approved to be used in conjunction with ivermectin.
How about that? And you know, we're starting to hear, and you're probably going to hear more, they're starting to put talk about HIV and AIDS again, which is interesting. When
Well,
Tony
that's supposed to be
Fauci.
coming out with that's supposed to be
Yeah,
coming
and
out from the CDC soon, whether it be by the CDC or whistleblowers.
And AZT was this drug that Fauci pushed on so many people who died because of the drug. It was very similar. You had people that were mostly asymptomatic, had no symptoms, but were terrified of this AIDS thing, that would go get the HIV test. And much like the PCR test, it would have lots of false positives. They never even isolated the HIV virus, just like they've never isolated COVID-19, let alone any of their strains, Omicron or whatever. They're just making up names. No, they can't prove it exists because they can't test for it. But Fauci and his people killed an unknown people because what they would do, then they would treat them with AZT, which was a rejected chemotherapy drug. You realize how bad some of the real chemotherapy drugs are that to reject that. You know how bad it must have been. And once they stopped giving AIDS patients AZT, pretty much disappeared. You don't hear about anything about AIDS anymore until now they're starting to bring it back. And I'm concerned. I don't know what they're planning to do here, but who knows? Everything seems to have gotten lost in the Ukraine shuffle, so I'm not sure what they have planned for.
Yeah, and if you got half a brain, you can watch the news and see what a joke it is, and see your favorite movie clip on there as being war. But it's, you know, I mean, they had a clip from Tropic Thunder on there the other night, and I just died laughing.
Well, sure. There's so many great memes, and you know, it's obvious. You know, that people are not questioning this. I was questioning COVID from the beginning, and you know, I was publishing on my social media from March, April 2020, when the CDC first gave the directive to hospitals that you were to list the cause of death as COVID-19, even when the patient was never tested for it. And when the CDC was sending out its statistics every week, there was always a disclaimer for, and of course the amount of deaths went up and down. They're all over the place, and nobody cares. You can't get people interested. Everyone has a disclaimer note: presumed cases are included. In other words, cases they weren't tested, they can't prove them.
Well, you know, if they're paying the hospital bill and then they pay for the funeral cost,
Yeah.
there's not going to be a lot of people that are going to question the blood money payout they got.
Exactly. Well, please take. Josh, I urge you to take that money because they're going to pay it anyhow. At least they'll give you a little relief. But the fact they're doing it, you and I both know they would never do that for any other disease, any other reason. They're doing this because, again, they want to make people, because you know, final expenses are very expensive, and they want to make people, oh wow, it's really great, you know, that they helped out, because it does help. But it's people need to look at the whole thing. They're behaving differently than they have with anything else, and it's pretty obvious, because you can see, the more I hear, I've gotten stories from people all around the world. I picked your guys, and we've had a couple last few shows. I've had other people like that. So many people have gone through similar things to what my brother did, and it's just a tragedy. We have no way of knowing how many people are being killed by what they're aptly calling the hospitals killing fields, and they really are.
Well, you know, I've heard stories of where county ambulance providers or, you know, their county employees, they find out what the county's making and they're getting directives not to let people refuse treatment and stuff and take everybody to the hospital. And then they find out what the county's making and then they threaten to blow the whistle on it. Well, they got a bonus in an odd time of the year and it's, you know, $11,000. And, you
I've
know,
heard that
I
too.
went partially to school to be a medic and that's a 30-year annual salary. So, you know, most of those people, you know, they got a car payment, a house payment, and that's a lot of money to them.
I
So,
got
you
him
know, they're going to
saying,
shut up about it.
Stephanie, you were trying to say something. What were you saying?
What I was trying to say is, what I find odd is all these expenses that this has incurred, all these people that have passed away, and nobody wants to hold anybody accountable for it. Like, I feel like there was some biological weapon released on us, and there's no consequences for it. There's absolutely no consequences for it. And, you pay this bill off, you pay that bill off. It looks like if, the United States was not responsible for this, that, even if, this came out of the Wuhan lab in China, why aren't we going to China to pay some of these bills? Why is America picking up the tab for it? If this is something that happened as a result of what China has done.
Well, what
Well,
if
and
we
I
did
mean,
it to ourselves?
and we know that they have, that the government has now admitted. The other day, when they smeared people like us as conspiracy theorists who talked about it, that there are bio labs in the Ukraine, and of course they're trying to blame it on Russia, Russia, Russia. But the United States obviously has a vested interest there. What are in those labs? And so, yeah,
They
you're
said
right.
the lab. They said the labs were not U.S. run, but they also said in the fine print that they were funded by us, that we
Exactly.
did
Exactly.
contribute funding. So
Right. And
it's people read headlines, don't read articles, and it just
Exactly.
they'll
And
put anything as a headline and people believe it.
I think, I don't have any idea, I don't know what exactly to what extent COVID is real or not real or anything different, but I do know, I don't know how many people, and I've been researching this, I don't know how many people have died of so-called COVID without going to a hospital. I think it'd be interesting to see, because then, of course, it plays into your guys' experiences, my brother's experience.
Right,
How many
right.
people really would have died if they hadn't gone to the hospital? I think it'd be interesting to do research on how many died outside of a hospital. And if it's, I suspect it's very few, a very small
So,
percentage. And, go ahead, Josh.
I'm sorry. So, if it was a real pandemic, you'd have bodies piling up in apartment complexes where people are clustered
Right.
together. You'd have bodies piling up in hotels. I mean,
Right.
it would be crazy. But everybody that dies that I've heard of is in the hospital, and most of them got remdesivir. I mean, I know a guy that's 75 years old, and he got COVID, and his heart doctor says, "Whatever you do, don't go to the hospital. Stay at home,
Yeah.
and I'll send you stuff." And
Absolutely.
I went to CVS and brought him some vitamins, and other people brought him stuff, and I was really worried about him, but shoot, he's back at work as a plumber right now.
That's my advice
Seventy-five
also.
years old.
Yeah.
Wow, that's great. That's what I tell my friends. If they get the sniffles, if they get anything, if they even remotely think that they have something that could be diagnosed as COVID, I say stay away from the hospitals. That's the best advice I can give you. And, God forbid something was to happen to me now, whatever, I would really hesitate about going to the hospital. I would not want to go to the hospital. I would, want to call a healthcare team out here to my own home to take care of me because, up until all this, I didn't really realize you could get everything you needed at home to take care of you, like oxygen tanks and, home health to come out and do physical therapy, all those kinds of things. I'm glad that I made it through the hospital experience, but I don't ever want to do it again, and I don't advise it for anybody else to do it.
Well, you were very fortunate. We're just about out of time, so I want to Josh you first, and then Stephanie. Just sum up however you want. If you have anything to promote, or you want people to reach or whatever, I don't know that you do, but if you just however you want to sum things up, Josh first, and then Stephanie.
Yeah, it seems like the big medical system has gotten too big for its own britches, and it's all about money. Everything's all about money. Everywhere you look, anything gets too big, it's all about money. There's local hospitals that are small around here that their first line defense is ivermectin for COVID. There's doctors that are really good that are private practices. The big medical companies around here, they flat out tell their physicians, if you prescribe ivermectin, you'll be terminated on the spot. If anybody would like to reach out to me, my email address is nanocloth, NanoCloth at gmail.com.
Well, thanks, Stephanie.
I guess I just want to say that I think the nurses and doctors here in the United States that are actually in it for the right reasons, that have upheld their oath to do no harm. I thank those individuals. And I ask for those individuals to come forward and tell what they saw and tell what has been done to these people that don't have advocates, that's been done behind these closed doors and in these ICU units. I want those individuals to come forward and make it all make sense to us, because I know there's some good people out there. There's people that have left the medical field because they've seen things that they didn't never think that they never thought they would see. And I know there's somebody that's listening to this, that's watching this, that has had this on the tip of their tongue in the back of their mind. And I'm just asking them to come forward, because you don't realize how much comfort and knowing that the things that a person experiences is actually legitimate. Like, I just want somebody to legitimize and tell me, yes, those things have happened. You know, they're taking right. people's medical power of attorneys. They're giving this remdesivir. They're, you know, goal is to keep families away. Like, that's all I want. I just want somebody to tell me that my concerns are legitimate, because I know there's somebody out there that absolutely knows that and absolutely. Can break all this up. I mean, all it takes is one person, and then somebody else is going to stand up, and somebody else is going to stand up. And will anything ever come of it all? I really don't know, but you just have to hold out hope that
absolutely.
You know,
well, that's absolutely. Yeah. Well, you're absolutely right, Stephanie. We've got to go. But again, I want to thank both of you for telling your stories. And like Stephanie said, anybody out there, a lot of you already have contact me. I'm easy to contact you. There are lots of ways. And let me know your story. Maybe we'll have you on the show. Josh, my heart goes out to you. You know, it's again, just so many experiences like yours. And I keep fighting the good fight. Stephanie, congratulations for making it through. I hope you're back to 100% soon. Thanks so much for both of you being here. And thanks everyone for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care. Thank you.